Hugh Ross's. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox class. It's really good to have everybody. Last week was a pretty exciting time with A.J. Roberts. We went a half hour long and didn't lose a single person. It was pretty amazing. So it looks like Jamie's going to start us out with a couple of questions this morning. And if you have questions, I will continue to ask them. So we'll go for 15 minutes from now until 10:45 with questions. If you have questions that we lost last week or didn't get asked, please feel free to put them in the Q&A. We try not to respond to questions in the chat because we just can't keep track of two categories in our little brains here. So if you have questions, please keep them in, please put them in the Q&A and we'll be happy to ask them. So Jamie, I think you have, well, there's a Q&A here now. You want me to ask this, Jamie, or do you have something from last?
No, go ahead. I mean, yeah, we have questions, but they were kind of towards AJ, but we have questions in here, go ahead with the Q&A.
Okay, very good. I'm reading this without having pre-read it. So here we go. Hugh, we have a question from Keith Wilson. He says, when I first got into amateur astronomy, I knew that I had to face the challenge of how the Word and God and creation were in harmony or accord with each other. The first book I read before I discovered Hugh's works was Walter Mauder's book, The Astronomy of the Bible, an Elementary Commentary on the Astronomical References of Holy Scripture. Despite the outdated science, I found his exegetical work and commentary so helpful and soundly concordist. In it, he answers many of the accommodationalist claims made today. Are you familiar with this work and his arguments? In other words, on a firmament, well, that's it. Are you familiar with that argument?
Okay, if I were answering the question 20 years ago, I would say yes, but yeah, it's been more than 20 years since I've looked at it. So my familiarity isn't what it used to be. But I do agree with Keith's comments. It's an old book, but it's got some really good material in it.
Okay. You know, we had a question from last week, Hugh, and I'll try to paraphrase it. It had to do with, you have said in the past that astronomers tend to have a very high percentage of people who believe in God. Biologists tend to be fairly low, which makes no sense to me, but can you comment on that, and where do virologists sort of fit in that?
Okay, yeah, the good source to use would be Men and Women of Science. And I do comment on this in my book, More Than a Theory. And the surveys were begun back in 1918, 1916, and they were repeated towards the end of the 20th century. And there's been updates since. And, you know, people have been very interested about the general trends. What's interesting is we're really not seeing any significant trend. Back in 1916, they were basically surveying, research scientists in America. And at that time, mathematicians had the highest level of belief in God and an afterlife. And the lowest was the social sciences, with the life sciences in between. And that really hasn't changed over 100 years. It's still the same. So today, research mathematicians still have the highest belief. And say, what's the level? Well, the latest survey, and this goes back all the way to 1916, it's basically sitting at 80% of a research scientists that believe in God and believe that there's an afterlife. And you say, well, what's at the very bottom? The bottom would be like the social sciences. Things like sociology. And there, the level of belief in God and an afterlife is around the 1% level. Amongst the life sciences, it sits around about a 25% to a third. What's interesting is that you go back to 1996, astronomers were sitting at around 60%. That percentage has dropped. And what's now taken the place are chemists. Chemists are next to mathematicians and having the highest level of belief in God and an afterlife. And that's sitting at about two-thirds. So there is some up and down movement amongst the subdisciplines of the physical sciences and likewise amongst the life sciences. What I found interesting, this goes back to a TV show that we did in the late 1990s, where I brought three Caltech research biologists onto the show and basically asked them, you know, what level of belief do you see at Caltech? And they said, well, back in the 1970s, it was sitting between 1 and 5%. And in the late 1990s, it was up to around 25 to 30%. So each one was from a different research group of about 30 research biologists. And the percentage was, I remember, one quarter, one third, and one half amongst the three different groups. What was interesting is I asked them the question, how do you explain in the space of 25 years, a jump from 1 to 5% up to 25 to 35%? And they said, it's because Caltech basically required that people getting a doctoral degree in biology had to take upper level mathematics, not just a course in probability and statistics and you know, numerical analysis. They had to take advanced classes in calculus and differential forms and things like that. And they said, we think it's mathematics that really is responsible for the jump in the number of believers in the life sciences. And I think evidence for that, there is a major conference in 1966. It's never been repeated since, but it was a conference where they invited mathematicians to meet together with evolutionary biologists. And you can look at the proceedings of that conference. The mathematicians basically demolish naturalistic evolution through their mathematical models of the history of life. And what's interesting was the response of the evolutionary biologists. They said, never again are we going to have a conference like this. So, and I think you need to understand there's kind of a self-selection effect. People who are more likely to believe that there's a God behind nature tend to drift into the physical sciences. And those that discount the idea of a God are going to drift towards the more, how would I call, complex sciences. Complex in the sense that it's more difficult to establish what the statistical errors are, or even to understand what the systematic errors might be. And so the more complex the science, you know, like especially the social sciences, the more subjective it becomes, because you can't really get a handle on these error bars of the data, which means you've got a lot more room to believe whatever you want to believe. Whereas in the physical sciences, we're dealing with more concrete material where we can actually measure with high precision both the statistical errors and the systematic errors. And there you get a more you know, concrete demonstration that there has to be a God behind the whole system. So it's not, you know, I think there's two things going on. You got people self-selecting, you know, who decides to become a physical scientist, who decides to become a life scientist, who decides to become a social scientist. And then, you know, in terms of, you know, what are the boundaries that the database in the physical sciences puts upon belief, as opposed to the boundaries that you get in the social sciences. So to me, it's not surprising that physical anthropology, and especially cultural anthropology, has a very low level of belief. The question, where do virologists stand? I don't know. I would put that question to AJ as to where she thinks that stands. If I had to guess, I would say it probably falls in the range of where all the life sciences fall. I don't think it'd be significantly different than zoologists, botanists, and paleontologists.
Thank you, Hugh. We have a question from our friend Doug McComb in Monrovia. He says, what is time? Is God everlasting inside some sort of time, or did God create time? Are time and space separate, or are time and space one thing?
We could do a whole series on that question, but I'll try to be brief. The challenge is we human beings are constrained to a single dimension of time that can't be stopped or reversed. And for that reason, it's a challenge, even for mathematicians and physicists, to define time. I mean, it'd be one thing if we could get outside of our time dimension and examine it, but we can't. We're constrained within it. So that puts a limit on our capacity to come up with a really good definition of time. But one that works throughout all the sciences is that time is that dimension in which time moves forward, where the effects follow after the causes. So the causes come first, the effects come second. And what we observe about the time dimension in which we're constrained, we can slow it down, but we can't stop it, we can't reverse it. And it is linear. It's not two-dimensional, it's one-dimensional. We do have the space-time theorems, which prove that there was a moment at the beginning of the universe when space and time were created. And you know, Doug was asking the question, is it possible, excuse me, to separate the time dimension from the space dimensions? It is if we're talking very small size scales and time scales. When we're talking about it at a cosmic level, then we talk about the four space-time dimensions of the universe because they form a single geometric set. And what I tell lay people is don't try to visualize it. It can't be done. But that's really the way to understand the universe mathematically and physically on its largest scales, is that we're talking four dimensions. We live in a four-dimensional universe, where in some respects, the time dimension behaves like a fourth space dimension. Again, don't try to visualize it. But we need to understand God is not constrained by the space-time dimensions of the universe. He created them. And he's at one point that says, tells us in the Bible, a time will come when he'll remove them. So this universe is temporary. It's only going to remain in effect until the full number of humans that God intends to redeem have in fact been redeemed. Then at that point, we go to a brand new realm, the new creation. And as you look at Revelation 21 and 22, it has dimensions, but it's not the dimensionality of our universe. It's going to be quite different. And it's going to be different because there's going to be no possibility for evil or suffering. And I think we need to understand that too. The space-time dimensions we see in our universe play a significant role in God's hands as tools to permanently eradicate evil and suffering. So when evil and suffering are no longer an issue, we no longer have to be constrained to length, width, height, and time. We can be delivered into a completely different dimensional realm. If you want to read about it, you can get my book, Beyond the Cosmos, and a free chapter is available at reasons.org/Ross.
Thank you, Hugh. We've got 1 minute left. Do you want to take one more question or do you want to go ahead with your lesson?
Well, let's take one question, but let's pick one that's not quite as involved as Doug McComb's question.
Well, here's a ironically, this question is from someone named Gabriel about angels. He says, can angels read your mind? And if not, in the realm of demonic possession, once they enter your body, can they read your mind?
Okay, good question. God knows every thought we think. So our thoughts are not our private possession. God is aware of everything we think. But that's not true of the angels. Unless we give them permission. If we give them permission, basically through our occult involvements, then we're basically inviting an angelic being to come into our body and take control of our body. And when that happens, they can feed thoughts into our mind. They can take control of our thoughts, but they need permission. They cannot do that unless we give them permission. And you say, why would anybody ever do that? Well, what the demons of fallen angels basically do is they come to certain vulnerable human beings and say, do you want power? I will give you power if you will give me control over your mind or over your body. And so they're basically making a bargain with you. If you want secret information, if you want power, And that's what happens when people get demon possessed, is they do take on powers that normal people don't possess. But it's not the power of the individual. It's a demon working within. And I think we need to understand that our physical body is not the real you. I kind of use the analogy. Our physical bodies are like the automobiles we drive. Yeah, our automobiles can express our personality. But when we leave the automobile, that automobile no longer really is there to possess or express our personality. And there will come a time when our body will die and decay, just like your automobile will die and decay. And when it does, you got to get a new one. And we will get a new body. And the new body we get will be one that will be permanent. It'll be eternal. It'll be incorruptible. But it's still the spirit within that new body that's going to express the real you. And so, I mean, that's the message of Christianity, that the death of the human body is not the death of the individual. When God creates a spiritual being, that spiritual being is a being that will continue to be conscious and exist for the rest of eternity. All angels are spiritual beings. All humans are spiritual beings.
Okay. Thank you, Hugh. Yeah, go ahead and get started with the lesson.
We'll do that. And let me open with a word of prayer, and then we'll jump into it. Father in heaven, I want to thank you for giving us this day. Thank you, Lord, that you give us a Sabbath every week in which we can put aside our normal work and really focus on the most important issues of life. And I pray you would do that for each one of us this day. Lord, open us up to receive more of your life, your truth, and your love. And Lord, help us to express that love, life, and truth to everyone that we meet. So Lord, I pray that you would cause each of us to be submissive before you in these next few minutes of this Paradoxes class. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, I want to begin by thanking Ann Jeanette Roberts for taking my place last week. Kathy and I had a really refreshing vacation, hiking and mountaineering in southwestern Colorado with some friends of ours there. It was a wonderful experience, very refreshing. But Ann Jeanette Roberts is one of the world's foremost virologists. She's now working for the U.S. Patent Office, and her job there is to review all the scientific literature coming out on viruses, and in particular, COVID-19. So, I'm planning at some point to bring AJ back. I think, in talking with her, she'd like to wait until there's a little more development on both the vaccines and the treatments for COVID-19, and not just COVID-19, but potentially future viruses that could become a pandemic. So I think we'll do that. We'll wait a few months, and I'll be checking in with her just to see what the status of the literature is. But I know a lot of you want to ask her more questions. And her comment is, well, give me some time. I'll have more answers. So we'll do that. But I'm glad that you all enjoyed the time you had with Ann Jeanette last week. And we're in the midst of a series on God's two books, the Book of Nature and the Book of Scripture, and particularly the challenges that are happening in modern day conservative seminaries and theologians reacting to this doctrine that God indeed reveals himself through two books reliably and in a trustworthy manner, where the books significantly overlap, also referred to as a doctrine of concordism. So we're going to pick up where we left off 2 weeks ago. But a lot of you asked me if I had a new discovery, and I actually do. So I'm going to jump into that, and then we'll finish up the teaching time with looking at this idea. Is it really credible to interpret any parts of the Old Testament and with the idea that these Bible authors believe that there is a metal vault over the earth? So we'll jump into that. But let me share screen so that you can see my visuals. Okay, here we go. And I always begin with this slide. It basically just tells you where you can go if you want more answers. All of our scholars at Reasons to Believe maintain a Facebook and a Twitter page, and you're welcome to ask some questions there. And hey, if you haven't already signed up for it, you can subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's free, and we have new postings of videos on a regular basis there. And I wrote this book a few years ago on due revelation. I'm actually going to do an update on this book, and it's going to be more focused. More Than a Theory was basically a book designed to give a summary of the testable creation model that we are developing at Reasons to Believe. And our team has asked me to write a much more focused book, a book that basically defends moderate concordism and deals with the challenges to the two books doctrine that's emerging in conservative theological circles. But you can get a free chapter of More Than a Theory at reasons.org/Ross. And I think I've got our team at Reasons to Believe actually having all of my books now available there, where you get free chapters of any of my books at reasons.org/Ross. By the way, that also works for the books of the rest of the scholars on staff at Reasons to Believe. So you can go to reasons.org/Rana or reasons.org/Zwierink or reasons.org/samples to get free chapters of their books. And years ago, we did do this docudrama on dual revelation. You're welcome to view that. It's a DVD. And this is the address you're going to need to go into our web meeting. We will have a web meeting. And what we'd like to do is kind of role play in our web meeting what we've been learning in the webinar. So around about noon, we're going to segue from the webinar to the web meeting. And that's where you can turn on your cameras and your microphones. And the role play we're going to work on is what I call you're at the water cooler, and you meet someone there that you've not known before. It's a stranger. You get into a conversation. They find out you're a believer, and they want to know how you became a believer. And then bystanders jump in. So this is going to be an opportunity for all of us to kind of role play. And, that's often happens. It happens to me all the time. Well, I'll strike up a conversation with a stranger in a grocery store or in a bank or whatever, and then other people want to jump in on the conversation. So that'll be the role play that we'll be practicing in the Zoom meeting. But the discovery I want to talk to you about is published just before Kathy and I went on our vacation. And it has to do with the Earth's magnetic field and the moon's magnetic field. And this particular slide I got here shows you the dynamo inside the Earth's core that's operating today, where you got a solid inner core, basically of iron, nickel, and cobalt, and a smattering of other elements. And then out beyond that, you got a liquid core made up of roughly the same components, predominantly iron with about 5 to 6% of a nickel and cobalt and less than 1% other elements. And so you got this liquid iron core circulating around a solid inner core. And, the book I got coming out in March, Design to the Core, actually has three chapters on the interior of the Earth, and explains that there's actually three different mechanisms that are working to circulate this liquid iron. And it's very efficient because of the fact you've got a solid inner core and you've got a liquid outer core. And so that's the interior of the Earth today, and explains why we have this dynamo operating. You will not get a magnetic field. Iron, cobalt, and nickel are what we call ferrous metals, easily magnetized metals, but they cannot be magnetized unless you get them circulating. So you need to get a strong magnetic field and a magnetosphere about the Earth. You need the liquid iron and cobalt nickel in the interior of the Earth to be circulating. It's that circulation which sets up the dynamo and establishes the magnetic field. But this paper that just got published is basically making the point that I've made before. That's not the way it was when the Earth was young. When the Earth was young, the Earth was still cooling down from its formation event. And so the entirety of the liquid core of the iron and the inner core of the Earth, all of it was liquid. And if all of it is liquid, it's much more difficult to circulate that iron, nickel, and cobalt and get a magnetic field. But the Earth did have a strong magnetic field 4 billion years ago, back to 4.5, 6, 7 billion years ago when it first formed. And I put out an article, a Today's New Reason to Believe article, back in November 16, 2020. Every week I post an article called Today's New Reason to Believe. It almost always posts on Monday, so I'll be posting one tomorrow, for example. But back in November 16, 2020, I posted an article explaining how it was that the Earth had a strong magnetic field in spite of the fact that the entirety of its metallic core was liquid. I mean, the Earth was so hot at that point that all of it was liquid. So how did it get circulating? And basically made the point that we have an Earth-Moon system. And so it was a collision between two planets, the proto-Earth and another rocky planet, Theia, that happened about 90 million years after the Earth formed. And it was that collision, more accurately a merger between Theia and the proto-Earth, that made the Earth a little bit bigger, generated a lot of heat, which made its core liquid, but it also produced the moon. And when it produced the moon was very close to the Earth. And ever since then, the moon's been spiraling away from the Earth. So today, the moon is an average of 239,000 miles away from the Earth. However, when the Earth was young, if you go back 4 billion years ago, we have the Earth and the moon relatively close together. And this next slide shows you what would happen when you got the Earth and the moon close together. So this is showing different orientations where you, and to understand this particular figure, we got the sun off to the left. So the sun is off to the left, and the sun when it was young was pouring out a powerful solar wind and a lot of solar particles. And this wind and particles basically pushed against the magnetosphere. But this is a point where 4 billion years ago, you got the moon about 21 Earth diameters or Earth radii away from the Earth. So the moon and the Earth are relatively close together. So, and both of them had a hot core. So at that point, the moon had a hot core and the Earth had a hot core. However, they needed a way to circulate that metallic iron, cobalt, nickel. But they were close enough together that their mutual gravity was sufficient to circulate the iron, nickel, and cobalt in the interior of the moon, as well as in the interior of the Earth. And so this is how you get this, what they call a coupled magnetosphere. And so what's happening is, for example, the Earth, because it's so close to the moon, pulls more strongly on the near side of the moon than it does on the far side of the moon. And the difference between those two forces, the force on the near side of the moon and the force on the far side of the moon, is sufficient to circulate the liquid iron in the interior of the moon. And the moon is close enough to the Earth at this point that likewise, it pulls more strongly on the Earth's near side than it does the far side. And the difference between those two forces is powerful enough to circulate the liquid iron in the interior of the Earth. And so what happens when the Earth and the moon are both quite young is that they both have a magnetic field. And because of how close they are together, the magnetosphere of the moon and the magnetosphere of the Earth actually couple to form a single magnetosphere. And this works whether you got the moon closer to the sun than the Earth is, or as you see over to the right is where you got the Earth closer to the sun than the moon, because after all, you got the moon orbiting the Earth. Basically making the point, it doesn't matter where the moon is in its orbit about the Earth, you will get this coupled magnetosphere. The shape of the magnetosphere changes as the moon orbits about the Earth, but the magnetosphere remains in effect. And the magnetosphere, the coupled magnetosphere, is strong enough to protect life on the Earth. And it's also strong enough to prevent the radiation and the wind of the sun to basically sputter away Earth's atmosphere and Earth's ocean. What was remarkable about the paper that was published back in November of 2020 is that it was making the point, if it wasn't for this coupled magnetosphere, the early Earth would have lost all of its water and would have lost all of its atmosphere, and there would have been no possibility for life on planet Earth at any time. But because of this coupled magnetosphere, it was created a shield. The coupled magnetosphere created a shield that prevented the solar radiation from sputtering away all of Earth's water and all of Earth's atmosphere. And back in November, when I put out this article, I made the point that over the past 10 years, I put this at the very top. It's the greatest fine-tuning discovery of the past decade, because it's basically making the point, if you want life on the planet, it can only happen if you've got an Earth-Moon system virtually identical to the Earth-Moon system or the planet-Moon system we see here with the Earth and the Moon. In other words, there's lots of moons in our galaxy. There's lots of planets in our galaxy, but we don't expect to find very many planet moon systems that are identical in their features to the Earth-Moon system. In fact, most astronomers would say the probability is zero. The Earth-Moon system is such an incredibly fine-tuned system that it must be unique in our galaxy and probably unique in the universe. And it's not just that the moon has to be a particular size and composition, and the Earth a particular size and composition. They have to be a certain distance. They have to have the same history of a forming, the way the moon formed, and then the moon separating from the Earth as it has separated. Now, what's new? This got published just a few days ago, is making the point, this paper that came out last November really wasn't able to put an accurate date on when the moon lost its magnetic field. Thanks to new research, that date is now available. And people were anticipating this. And the big anticipation was, is the date that they come up with going to be consistent with what was published back in November? And is it going to be consistent in establishing that this is a really remarkable fine-tuning argument that there must be a supernatural creator and designer behind the Earth-Moon system? And the issue has been the fact that when you look at the Apollo rocks, and by the way, almost all the rocks we got come from the Apollo program. The Russians brought back a few grams of moon material, but the Apollo program brought back literally hundreds of kilograms, tons of lunar material. And this next slide just shows you some examples of lunar rocks. And the one in the middle came in at many kilograms. It was actually a big rock. I actually can see the astronaut struggling to get it up on the spaceship. So these are some examples of lunar rocks. And the Apollo mission basically was designed to collect rocks of great variety from all over the moon. So they purposely sent the Apollo missions to different parts of the moon to collect different rocks. And now what's happening is that they've been noticing that the magnetization we see in these rocks varies all over the place. And it seems like people have been publishing papers saying, we think the moon retained its magnetic field to as recently as a half billion years ago or a billion years ago. But that was in conflict with models that astrophysicists have developed for how quickly they would expect the core of the moon to cool. Its core is much smaller than the core of the Earth. even on a percentage basis, it's very much smaller. And so the anticipation is that, yes, the moon began with a liquid iron core, but that liquid iron core would cool very quickly and become solid, and that would be the end of the moon's magnetic field. And yet we see a lot of rocks that are quite young that have a magnetic field, in some cases a magnetic field just as strong as what we measure in Earth rocks. Well, it was a team of researchers that basically figured out what's going on with all these discordant magnetization measurements in lunar rocks. And so this is from the paper that was published a few days ago in Science Advances. There's a citation going to look at it. And I did do a tweet on it. So if you go to my Twitter page, you'll be able to. And by the way, this is a paper that you can read in its entirety for free. That's a wonderful thing about Science Advances. There is no page charge. Anybody can read the entire article for free. So you'll find a link there on my Twitter page. But what they noted in the introduction of the paper is that several lunar rocks that are only a few million years old show strong Earth-like magnetization. However, all of these rocks are found at impact sites. And so what Tardunu and his team basically was pointing out, yes, we find lots of rocks on the moon that manifest a strong magnetic field, but the young ones are always rocks that are found at impact sites. And so they went into the lab and cited other research papers, which basically make the point, if you've got a meteorite or an asteroid that strikes, experiments reveal that asteroidal and cometary impacts can impart a strong magnetization to these rocks, and they can even maintain that magnetization for tens and hundreds of millions of years. And so basically what Tardunu is saying, if we want to understand the history of the moon's magnetic field, we have to ignore all rocks that are the product of an impact event. And hey, all you got to do is look at the moon. You can see craters everywhere. The moon is constantly being impacted because, unlike the Earth, it doesn't have an atmosphere that can burn up most of the impactors. And so the moon is being pelted all the time. And you know, when you do get an impact, it magnetizes the rocks in the vicinity of the crater. So you got to get away from the crater and try to recover rocks that are not the product of impact events. And so what they did is they analyzed five lunar rocks within a date range of about 4 to 3 billion years ago. And then they also looked at nine other lunar rocks that have been measured by the research teams. So they came up with a total database of 14 lunar rocks in the range of 3.94 to 3.17 billion years. And these are rocks that are not the result of impacts. And they show that every one of them has a magnetic field that they were not able to measure. So basically telling us we're looking at a magnetic field that's much weaker than a fraction of a Gauss. The Earth's magnetic field comes in, depending where you are on the Earth, between about 20 and a 65 Gauss. And they're saying all of these rocks, it's quite a bit below one Gauss. And therefore, they drew the following conclusion, that the moon lost its intrinsic magnetic field about 4 billion years ago. Yeah, if you get to 4 billion and older, everything's got a strong magnetic field. But once you get younger than 4 billion years, many rocks have a strong magnetic field, but a lot of rocks do not. And they say, we need to look at those rocks. And that's clear evidence that the moon lost its magnetic field about 4 billion years ago. And this was a huge sigh of relief within the community of planetary astronomers, because they said their models of the interior physics of the moon all said that by the time you get to 4 billion years ago, the moon's liquid iron core becomes solid. And once it becomes solid, that should be the end of the moon's magnetosphere. So yeah, you got individual rocks that show magnetic field, but we don't see a general magnetic field for the moon once we get past 4 billion years ago. Now, in terms of what that means for life on planet Earth, let me show you this graph here. And this graph is basically showing you what the radiation and wind intensity and particle intensity of the sun is with respect to time. And what you see on the y-axis, the flaring activity level, which would also be the particle radiation level, the solar wind level, they're all correlated. That's a logarithmic scale. And so when you look at that y-axis, you've got a factor of more than 100,000 times between the maximum solar level and the minimum solar level. And I want you to note that right now we're at the minimum level. The sun, like all stars, reaches its greatest stability when it's about perfectly middle-aged. And so here we are at 4.57 billion years after the birth of the sun. The sun has gone halfway through its nuclear burning time. It's capable of burning for about 9 billion years. So we're right at the halfway point. And the halfway point is when the flaring activity level reaches a minimum. The particle radiation from the sun reaches a minimum. The wind reaches a minimum. This is the best time to be living on planet Earth. It's the safest time in terms of your danger of being impacted by bad solar radiation. So that blue dotted line tells us where we are right now. That green dotted line you see over to the left marks the time when the moon would have lost its magnetic field. But I think what you're going to see there is that that protects the water and the atmosphere of planet Earth during that period when the solar's radiation and the solar wind and the solar particle emission is at its greatest, where it's strong enough to actually evaporate away all of Earth's water and sputter away all of Earth's atmosphere. Once you get past that green dotted line, the Earth's magnetosphere by itself becomes strong enough to prevent the planet losing all of its water and all of its atmosphere. It only needs a coupling of the moon's magnetosphere during that early era when the solar radiation is more than 10,000 times greater than what it is right now. And you say, well, what happened after that green dotted line? This is when the Earth began to form a solid inner core, and that produced alternate circulation methods to replace the circulation that we got from the moon being close enough to us to powerfully circulate the liquid iron in our core, in the core of the Earth. So this is a nice confirmation of what got published back in November. And by the way, you'll see a fairly detailed article on this coming out from me as part of the Today's New Reason to Believe series. It will be published September 20th. But I wanted to give all of you in the Paradoxes class the latest. It got published in the scientific literature, literally, just 10 days ago. The article will be coming out on the September 20th. But basically makes the point. This really is a powerful fine-tuning argument, in the sense that the only way you're going to have a planet that's going to have life on it, especially advanced life on it, is you need a moon virtually identical to our moon that forms the same way our moon did by the merging of two rocky planets to make a bigger planet, where the planet is orbiting just the right distance from the sun, and where you get the moon spiraling away from the Earth at just the right distance. So that you get this coupled magnetosphere operating during the time when it's crucial to prevent the host star from sputtering away all the atmosphere and all the water. So this is all going to be showing up in my new book, Design to the Core. In fact, I'll be updating that book literally these next few weeks to include this new discovery. So that's the discovery, and I'll be welcome to take questions on it during Q&A time. But what I'd like to do is get back to our lesson on a dual revelation. And these past few weeks, we've been talking about accommodationism. I've already given you four distinct definitions of accommodationism. I'm going to give you some more. Because this is what I consider accommodationism to be the big theological challenge to understanding the Bible, the whole of the Bible, as being the inspired, inerrant Word of God, where we can take the texts that deal with creation and science literally rather than as mytho-history or mythology or legend or just texts that we should be ignoring because they have human errors embedded in them. And that's what accommodation is, very basically. It's the idea that the Holy Spirit partners with the human authors to give us the Bible in such a way that what the Holy Spirit is revealing to us is totally true, trustworthy, and reliable. But the Holy Spirit, in partnering with the human authors, accommodates the mistaken scientific views of the human authors, doesn't try to alter or change them, basically just accommodates them. So that's what accommodationism is in a nutshell, but it's got a lot of subcomponent definitions. If you want to get caught up, you can go back at paradoxes.org. MP3s there are available that you can download. There's no charge, and you can get caught up at where we are. So I'm not going to repeat what we covered in previous weeks. We're going to jump in to one of the latest wrinkles in accommodationism. And this is one of the claimed mistaken biblical views that they believe gets incorporated, especially into the book of Genesis, was that the earth was flat with a metal dome a short distance above it, in which the sun, moon, and stars were attached and through which rain and snow fell. And this is now getting into public school textbooks. I think many of you may have seen this. I was exposed to this as a child, basically in looking at some of the legends of the ancient Mesopotamians. And this is a diagram that they often show in the textbooks. But this is what the accommodationists are claiming influenced what we see recorded in the book of Genesis. And so the idea is that you've got a flat earth, and this flat earth sits on a huge ocean. And then you've got the underworld or hell sitting below the surface of this flat earth. And so you got hell between the surface of flat earth and the primeval ocean that is below. But above the flat earth, you've got this metallic dome. And so they say that the ancients believed that the sky above us, there was a metallic dome there. And on the inside of the metallic dome was attached the sun, moon, and the stars. And they also claimed that the ancients believed that the rain and the snow came to us from an ocean of heaven. You've got this primeval ocean, but above the metal dome, you got water sitting above that metal dome. And there are little gates in this metal dome. You can think of them as pores or gates. And they said occasionally the gods would open up those gates, and that explains where rain comes from and where snow comes from. It comes from this huge ocean of liquid water that sits above the metal dome. And so occasionally the gods would open up holes in the metal dome, and that explains where the rain and the snow comes from. And so what's being promoted by modern day theologians, and I want to make this clear, it's not just the liberal theologians. They've been promoting this for the past 250 years. But we now have conservative theologians at the most conservative Bible-believing seminaries promoting this view. This is what the ancients believe. This is what all the nations around Israel believe. And the Israelites likewise believe this. And this is what got incorporated into the early chapters of Genesis. And that's why the accommodationists would say, we cannot understand Genesis 1 to 11 to be historical books. They're not writing about history. They're not writing about science. They're not writing about creation. What we have in the early chapters of Genesis are figures of speech designed to communicate a higher message about God's purposes, about the functions of creation, about God's intent to bring people to faith in Christ. And some have interpreted as basically a metaphor for what God is doing in heaven. So there's a variety of interpretations of how this plays out in theological circles. But let me give you some quotes from some of the leading conservative theologians promoting this view. This is actually from an atheist website. And this is what I find ironic. You've got a community of atheists and you've got a community of conservative Bible-believing scholars basically promoting the same view. And so this is from the website, The Vaulted Earth. It's an atheist website, but they've been publishing articles. And one of the articles, they say, quote, all ancient cosmology everywhere was a stationary enclosed plane, basically making the point all the ancient peoples believed that the earth was flat, the earth was sitting on top of a vast ocean, and there was a metal dome above the flat earth. And if you go on with the Vaulted Earth site, they basically make the point that no matter where you go, Egyptians, Hindus, Incas, Navajos, the Hebrews, the Norse, the Mayans, they all had some concept of a flat earth with a metal dome above the earth and with waters above that metal dome that explains the precipitation. Now, they do have a point. If you look into the ancient literature of these different cultures, you will find stories like this. Like, for example, in India, they talk about how the flat earth sits above a giant turtle. And above the turtle are these elephants that support the flat earth. And then you've got this dome above it, etc. And you're probably aware in some Hindu beliefs, they believe it's turtles all the way down. So underneath that turtle, there's another turtle, an infinite number of turtles all the way down. Now, what I want to address is, yes, this does show up in ancient literature, but are we really correct in concluding that this is what all the ancients actually believed? Or is this simply fantasy? And that's a point I want to make, is that even our modern day culture is filled with fantasy. And we've got to be careful to distinguish between fantasy and science. And I'm going to be making the point the ancients did the same thing we do today. They had their fantasy, they had their science, and they knew the difference between their fantasy and their science. So I'm basically making a point, yes, this is in the literature, but all the ancients understood this to be fantasy. None of them believed this to be reality. The problem is you've got modern day theologians claiming that this was actually the science of the ancient peoples. So moving from that, let's just look at what they claim the Israelites believed. Well, there's a book, it's actually an article, a lengthy article by two theologians, Keel and Schroer, in the journal Creation, and they make this point. This is what people are claiming the Hebrews believed. However, no complete image or drawing of an ancient Israelite conception of the world has ever been found. And so they're basically saying, we're imposing this upon the Israelites. And I've talked to people like John Walton, and he actually concedes this point. He says, yes, we can't find an image or a drawing that in Israelite or Hebrew literature that shows this. But his point is, all the peoples around the Israelites believed this, and the Israelites basically incorporated ancient Near Eastern literature into their theology, into the book of Genesis, and elsewhere throughout the Old Testament. And so they do admit, yes, we can't find it in Israelite literature, but they said the Israelites must have believed this because all the people around them believed this. Well, there is a book put out by Junker and Davidson. They contributed to a book. And this is a whole book basically making the point, the myth of the solid heavenly dome. Highly recommend the book because it's filled with articles written by scholars who are not only theologians, but Assyriologists, archaeologists. And basically it's a book filled with articles making the point, the idea that the ancients believed in a solid dome above a flat earth is a complete myth. They recognize it as fantasy. They did not see it as reality. And so this is one quote from the article by Yonker and Davidson. They said, a Syrian specialist, Wilfred Lambert, quote, could find no evidence that the Mesopotamians believed in a hard-domed heaven. And this is, I think, really crucial, because what I'm seeing from the accommodationists is they're insisting that this was the predominant worldview of everybody living in Mesopotamia, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Sumerians, that they all believed this. But here's Wilfred Lambert saying that he could find no evidence that anyone in Mesopotamia ever believed in a hard dome heaven. Couldn't find the literature. He says, yes, we do find these images, but nothing that actually establishes that the Mesopotamians believed in this hard dome earth. And let me finish with this before we go into our second Q&A time. This is from Gerhard Hazel in the Journal of the Evangelical Quarterly. He says, Genesis 1 is, quote, not only a complete break with ancient Near Eastern mythological cosmologies, but represents a parting of the spiritual ways brought about by conscious and deliberate anti-mythical polemic. And you know, next week we'll get into this, is that yes, you do find myths in the ancient Near Eastern literature, but the ancient people in the ancient Near East understood this to be myth. They also understood that these myths had a political agenda. And this is something that Gerhard Hazel did not deal with in his article. But when you look at Genesis chapters 1 through 11, there's not a hint of politics throughout those 11 chapters. But all you got to do is look at the Enuma Elish, or the Gilgamesh epic, and there's politics everywhere. And basically what you see is a common denominator amongst all these Near Eastern myths, as they come up with this fantasy story of the gods and human beings, and how the gods are demanding service from the human beings. And so humans are here to wait upon the pleasures of the gods. But this is used as an analogy to basically communicate, we nobles are to be waited on by the rest of you humans. And so what you see in the ancient Near Eastern culture, it's a two-tier society where you got the kings and the nobles at the top, and you got the rest of the mass population at the bottom. And basically the nobles are telling the serfs, you need to understand your place. You're there and your job is to serve us and please us. That's your job, just like it's the job of all humanity to serve and please the gods. And I think we're going to spend some time on this, basically making a point. If we understand the political agenda, we can understand the reason why the ancients established these fantasies in contrast with their science. And I think what really concerns me about these modern day conservative theologians, they're so dismissive of these ancient peoples. They're basically making the point that they're scientifically ignorant, or they didn't care two bits about cosmology or science or creation. And so we're going to take some time to dispel that mistaken notion. And I'm actually going to be citing how we astronomers actually tap into ancient cosmology to actually further our scientific research. So that'll be next week. So we'll stop there. Let me stop the share feature. And I think we're back on to Ross and Jamie, and we'll take the next time up until noon to deal with questions. And then at noon, we'll segue into the web meeting for those of you that can join us there.
Very good. Thank you, Hugh, for that. That was wonderful. David Edwards here in Rancho Santa Margarita, California asks, can you recommend a source that describes the direct measurement method of star distance with masers?
Yes.
Understand the math for the distance to the masers as the base of the triangle, then the math for how that is used to measure the distance to stars 50 to 470 million light years away.
Right. Yeah, that's important, because young Earth creationists, in their attempt to conclude that the universe is only thousands of years old, will often say, "We astronomers do not possess direct distance measurements. Our direct distance measurements only go out to 200 or 300 light years. So we can't go out to beyond 6,000 light years." That's not even accurate in terms of the standard method. The standard method, where we have no assumptions, and I think that's key, because young Earth creationists will say, hey, in terms of measuring galaxies, all of our distance measurements have assumptions built into them. But they do recognize that we have another distance measurement that is assumption-free. And this is the method we all learned in high school geometry, that if you have a triangle that's an isosceles triangle, where you can measure the length of the base of the triangle, and you can measure the angles at the end of each base, that gives you, without any assumptions, the distance to the vertex. And so typically how astronomers have measured distances to stars, they use as a base of the triangle the orbit of the Earth about the sun. That gives you a baseline of 186 million miles. And what you do is that at one point in the year, you measure the angle or the angle towards the star. And then 6 months later, when you're at the opposite end of the orbit, you measure the angle to the same star. And the difference in the two angles, if you can measure the angle accurately enough, gives you the distance to the star without any assumptions. And 100 years ago, that technique could give you accurate distance measurements out to stars 300 light years away. And then from then, we had to bootstrap. So you got what's called the distance ladder. You use measurements on nearby stars to calibrate other distance determining measurements. But young Earth creations are correct. When you do that bootstrap method, where you say you look at Cepheid variable stars that are nearby and use that as a distance measurement, a standard candle to get to stars that are Cepheid variable stars that are millions of light years away, that there's assumption built in. You're basically assuming that the Cepheid variable stars that are nearby behave just like the Cepheid variable stars that are far away. Now, I believe that assumption is very accurately proven to be correct. But what young Earth creationists are failing to recognize, we now have telescopes on satellites that are able to much more accurately measure those angles than what we could do with ground-based instruments. And so if you look at the scientific literature, we're able to go out to about 20 to 30,000 light years using the baseline of the Earth's orbit about the sun. But what's happened is we now can use a very different baseline. And these are masers. You say, what's a maser? That's a microwave laser. So I think everybody understands what a laser is. A maser is simply the same thing at microwave wavelengths. While there are maser sources that orbit about the center of galaxies, and these maser sources are very bright, and they have a very small diameter, so they're point sources. And so radio astronomers can actually measure the orbit of these maser sources about the center of a galaxy. So what they do is they say, well, they'll measure the movement of the maser over 20 or 30 years. That's enough time that they can calculate the orbit of the maser. And Newton's laws of motion tell us, if you can measure the movement of a maser source along its orbit about the center of the galaxy, you know, without any assumptions, the diameter of that orbit in meters or miles or light years or whatever you want. And so what radio astronomers do is that they will measure the orbit of these masers, but they can measure it to extremely high precision and the angles to these sources at extremely high precision because they couple together radio telescopes that are all over the world. Now that can't be done at optical wavelengths because at optical wavelengths, you get the brightness of the signal, but you don't get the position of the wave. the position of the wave is lost because of the disturbances of the light in the atmosphere of the Earth. But at radio wavelengths, the atmosphere of the Earth does not disturb the position of the wave. And so you get both the position and the amplitude. And when you get both the position and the amplitude, that enables you to link together radio telescopes all over the world, which means instead of having, say, a 400-inch diameter telescope to help you measure those angles accurately, you get a 5,000-mile diameter telescope. And so it's radio astronomers who are able to come up with the highest precision measurements of those angles. You say, how good are they? Well, it's now at a point where they're able to measure angles that are thousandths of an arc second. So very high precision angles. And by that means, they've been able to use direct distance measurements to measure the distances of galaxies as far away as 470 million light years. It only works if a galaxy has strong Maser sources. But we've now found strong Maser sources orbiting dozens of galaxies. And therefore, we can use these radio interferometers to measure the distances of galaxies. And the most distant measurement is now out of 470 million light years, which tells us that our cosmic distance scale is accurate. The assumptions that we have built in to bootstrapping out to more and more distant galaxies, we can use as direct distance measurement to tell us that the indirect distance measurements are reliable, accurate, and trustworthy, which means the distances really do correspond to the universe being billions of years old. And it's assumption-free. The young Earth creationists have got nowhere to go.
Hugh, I'm going to cheat a little bit and do an add-on question to that. Are there any young Earth creationists who concede this technology, and how do they deal with it?
Yes, there are some that concede it. I think Jason Lyle is one that concedes that, yes, this technology exists. It actually proves that these galaxies are hundreds of millions of light years away, and the light traveled to us over those hundreds of millions of light years. But he's come up with a convention where he makes the point that maybe the velocity of light is coming to us from these distant sources at an infinite velocity and moving away from us at half the velocity of light. Because he makes the point that we measure the velocity of light, we measure the round trip velocity of light, not the one way velocity of light. And so we just assume that the velocity of light is the same moving away from us as it is towards us. Now, when he first proposed this idea, he was talking about our planet Earth being a favored object in the universe, where light from everywhere else moves at infinite velocity towards the Earth and at half the velocity away from the Earth. And so this fits with our measurements of the return path of the velocity of light. It turns out that that's testable, that there are supernova eruptions in distant galaxies that are being gravitationally lensed, which means a supernova eruption light is coming to us on different travel paths, directly towards us, being gravitationally bent away from us, so you actually get different distances. But the last time I debated Jason Lyle, he said, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the velocity of light is infinite regardless of where the observer is. And it doesn't have to be the observer, it could be his instrument. Because, you know, I was making the point, hey, the James Webb telescope is going to be a million miles away from the Earth. And wouldn't there be a difference between the velocity of light coming to us, the path light coming to us on planet Earth, than the Hubble's or the James Webb telescope? And his point is, no, my position is it's infinite towards all observers, regardless of their position, regardless of their velocity. And it applies even to the non-human man instruments. So it doesn't matter whether it's a human observing or some telescope on a satellite or even the Voyager spacecraft. Now, in that debate, he said, Hugh, you need to understand, I'm not an evidentialist. I'm a presuppositionalist. And so what I now realize, he's come up with a model that it's impossible to scientifically test. It's 100% ad hoc. And I would describe him not as a presuppositionalist, but as a hyper presuppositionalist. He's basically saying evidence doesn't matter. So he's come up with his ad hoc idea. And because he believes it's infinite for all observers, no matter where they are, it's impossible to scientifically test it or to falsify it or to confirm it for that matter. So I think he keeps calling his model a scientific model. I think that's a mistake. It's not a scientific model because there's no way it can be confirmed. There's no way it can be falsified. There's no way it can be tested. And I do agree, yeah, he is a presuppositionalist. He basically says, my presuppositions are true and it's impossible to test or falsify by presuppositions. And he basically keeps waving the Bible, saying, this is what I believe. Nothing else counts. Well, the problem is there are differing interpretations of the Bible. How do we test those different interpretations? Who says his interpretation is correct? Everybody else's interpretation is wrong. And from a biblical perspective, the Bible does endorse evidentialism. And so I think he's got an issue with the Bible when he basically, and what I found ironic is I felt that debate was similar to my debate with the atheist Peter Atkins. Peter Atkins also said, hey, my atheism can't be scientifically tested. And so Jason is saying, my interpretation of the Bible can't be scientifically tested. And I'm okay with that as long as they don't call it a scientific model. But that's what bothered me both about Peter Atkins and Jason Lyle. They still claim that they have a scientific model, but both of them are hyper-presuppositionalists. My presupposition trumps everything.
Thank you, Hugh. Gabriel has another good question. He says, the magazine Forbes and science in general both seem to still make the claim that, quote, can never know if the universe has a spatial ending, close quote. How do we know if it has a border? And what is, if it has a border, what is its shape or its diameter?
Well, there's actually a point that those two magazines are making. You know, we astronomers are busy trying to measure the geometry of the universe. It measures flat to about four places of the decimal. If the universe is flat, we cannot determine its outer boundary. If it's spherical, yes, we can determine its boundary. If it's hyperbolic or flat, we can't. And right now it's measuring to be flat. And people ask me, well, can we ever come up with measurements more accurate than four places of the decimal? Well, the Big Bang theory is correct. I believe there's overwhelming scientific evidence and biblical evidence for that matter that establishes that it is correct. What that tells us, we'll never get to the fifth place of the decimal. We're close to getting the fourth place of the decimal, but inherent in Big Bang cosmology is a limitation on our ability to measure the geometry of the universe. So the bottom line is the answer to Gabriel's question forever is going to be, I don't know, until God takes us from this universe and puts us in the new creation. However, we do know that time is finite. We do know that the universe has only been in existence for 13.8 billion years. So there we can put a boundary on the universe. But spatially, we can't. And keep in mind, the universe we see through telescopes is not the universe of today. It's the universe of the past. Assuming you're not in Jason Lyle's camp, what we're looking at through our telescopes is the universe of the past. And actually, what I would say to young Earth creationists, you're missing something. The fact that the velocity of light is 186,000 miles per second, regardless of position or perspective, means that we are living at the one time in the history of the universe when we can directly observe 100% of cosmic history. And I believe God wanted us to read the entire book of scripture. He also wanted us to be able to read the entire book of nature. This is part of what we're trying to present here in our series on dual revelation, is that God gave us two books, and he ensured that we could read both books. And I think one of the big critiques of young earth creationism, if God had placed us here any earlier in cosmic history than 13.8 billion years after the cosmic creation event, we'd only be seeing part of the history of the universe. Because it takes time for light to travel along the space surface of the universe from the cosmic creation event to reach our telescopes. So if we were put here, say, 5 billion years ago, we'd only be able to see the past two-thirds of the history of the universe. On the other hand, if we were put here 5 billion years in the future, we likewise would only be seeing the past two-thirds history of the universe. Because if we go into the future, the space surface of the universe will expand at greater than the velocity of light, which means more and more of the universe will become inaccessible to us. But it also tells me God put us here at the precise time when we astronomers can look through our telescopes and directly observe all the way back to the cosmic creation event. I think God wanted us to read that book, because in being able to directly observe the cosmic creation event, we get some of the most compelling scientific arguments, evidence there must be a God beyond space and time that created the universe and designed it all for our perspective, for our existence, and not just for our existence, but for our redemption. That's a point I'm going to be making in my next book, Design to the Core, where I look at cosmic history from the beginning right out to the present and make the point all of it is designed to make possible the redemption of billions of human beings within a short period of time.
Thank you, Hugh. Jonathan Sparks asks, what are the chances of turning your books to audiobooks?
Oh, a lot of them already are as audiobooks. I think four of our books are now available as audiobooks. People can contact our office because they're not all available at one site. Different publishers have been turning them into audio products. And we're in the business of translating all of our written books into audiobooks. So that's a goal we have at Reasons to Believe. And I think we're on pace to bring out about two audiobooks per year. So by next year, there should be six audiobooks available. But yeah, if you contact our office, it'll tell you which books are available as audiobooks. The Creator in the Cosmos is available as an audiobook. Navigating Genesis is available as an audiobook. And I think Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. And if I had to guess, it's Why the Universe is the Way It Is. Those are all available as audiobooks. But the two more are in the works. Again, just contact our office. They'll tell you how to get a hold of them.
Thank you, Hugh. Susan Lambeau asks, did you see the news? I think it's new that the Milky Way has more arms than we thought. I get that from looking at hydrogen atoms.
Yes. I did see that article, and by looking at neutral hydrogen, you tend to get a more accurate picture of the spiral arm structure of a galaxy than you do if you just look at the star clusters. So that's what that article is all about. And, you know, there we have two main arms in our Milky Way galaxy, and then we got two other arms. But we also have what are called a lot of subarms. For example, our own sun is not on a main spiral arm. It's on a subarm. And in my book, Design to the Core, I cite that paper, but I actually show you the latest map we have of the spiral arms in the vicinity of our solar system and how those spiral arms are exquisitely designed to make possible advanced life in our solar system. I mean, what's interesting is you look at the spiral arm spur that we're on, we're in the best possible location on that spiral arm spur. And likewise, when you look at the Sagittarius arm and the Perseus arm, those are the two dominant arms of a Milky Way galaxy. Likewise, where we are on the spur arm is the best possible site relative to the Sagittarius spiral arm, as well as the Perseus spiral arm. So you see fine tuning all over the place on the spiral arms. And a big point I'm making in my book too, our Milky Way galaxy is the only spiral galaxy we have found so far that has got spiral arms of the necessary symmetry, separation, and a pitch angle that makes possible advanced life. When we look at galaxies far, far away, none of them are candidates.
Thank you, Hugh. Doug McComb is asking a clarification of this morning's teaching. He said, did the iron core of the Earth originate with the moon forming collision, or was there a metallic core even before the collision event?
Yes, good question from Doug. And even before the collision event, the Earth had a liquid metallic core. All planets, roughly the size of the Earth, when they form, basically you got material accreting. So you got asteroids, comets, planetesimals, they're being accreted, and the accretion process generates a lot of heat. So all the rocky planets, including Mercury and Mars, they're all big enough that through that accretion process, they begin with liquid iron cores. But the smaller the rocky planet, the more rapidly that liquid iron core cools. So yes, all the planets had a magnetosphere, but Earth is the only rocky planet that retained its magnetosphere. It's the biggest of the rocky planets. It's the densest of the rocky planets. Because of the way it formed and because of its relationship with the moon, it's retained a strong magnetic field up to this day. It's the only rocky planet that has. The Earth did have a liquid iron core before the moon forming event. The moon forming event injected extra heat. So the Earth of all the rocky planets has the greatest accretion heat. It has the greatest accretion heat, number one, because of it's the biggest, but number two, because the fact that Theia collided with it, that injected a lot of extra heat. And then what's also unusual about the Earth, it's got the greatest quantity of long-lived radiometric elements. So there's two sources that are driving our magnetic field today. There's the heat release from the accretion event, and there's also the heat being released from the decay of uranium, thorium, and potassium. And all this is in my next book, Design to the Core. I actually show you the heat sources, how the heat sources operate to circulate the magnetic field and sustain our magnetosphere.
Very good. Thank you, Hugh. Stephen Posta from Spring, Texas says, should the new scientific discovery that you shared this morning be added to the list of mandatory fine-tuning items that pretty much must be in place in order for advanced life to be possible?
Yes, now it even apply to any kind of life, because all life needs an atmosphere and an ocean. And, if a planet loses all of its atmosphere and all of its surface water, you're not going to have any kind of life existing. People have speculated, well, maybe you could have life in the deep interior. Well, as I mentioned in our book, Origins of Life, I wrote the chapter on life in the deep interior of planets and moons. You run into what's called the oxidants-antioxidants paradox, is that life needs oxidants in order to be sustained. But if you got oxidants, that prevents the origin of life. And so that's the reason why we can rule out deep interior life. If you want life, you can't have life in the deep interior, but that life cannot originate in the deep interior. It needs to be sustained by life on the surface. So you got to have surface life at some time. And surface life, at a minimum, needs liquid water and it needs an atmosphere. And yes, unless you've got this coupled magnetosphere, that's not going to happen. So this discovery is the strongest discovery I've seen in science, establishing what you see throughout the scientific literature. It's called the rare Earth doctrine, that Earth is not common, Earth is rare, and that Earth indeed may be unique in its capacity to sustain life. This is the greatest enhancement to the rare earth doctrine that's ever been published in the past decade.
Thank you, Hugh. Our friend Mark Durham asks kind of a follow-up to that. He says, in regard to the Earth and Moon's early coupled magnetospheres, is this proposing that life was on Earth prior to 4 billion years ago? If so, how much prior?
Yeah, there's no evidence that life existed at that time on Earth. The earliest undisputed date we have for life on Earth is 3.825 billion years ago. And that's got a tiny error bar, plus or minus 0.006 billion years. And you know, previous to that, you got the late heavy bombardment, which makes the Earth too hot for life. Although people have argued that previous to the late heavy bombardment, you could have had brief episodes in which you got liquid water. In fact, there's isotope evidence telling us that there are brief episodes between 3.8 billion years ago and 4.4 billion years ago, where you've got on small regions of the Earth, temporary liquid water and temporary solid rocks. But the argument we've made in our book, Origins of Life, is that from a naturalistic perspective, you're not going to get the origin of life in a small region over a short period of time. You really need the liquid water and the solid rocks to be a permanent feature. And that doesn't happen until after the late heavy bombardment. And it doesn't really happen until 3.825 billion years ago. One reason why I think that date is secure, any earlier date than that, you've got conditions that even naturalist origin of life researchers admit will not allow the origin of life. However, the conditions on the Earth previous to 3.8 billion years ago are crucial to determine whether you can get life after 3.8 billion years ago. If the water is all gone or the atmosphere is all gone, you're never going to get life. So it's crucial that the water in the atmosphere of the Earth be preserved during the first 600 million years of the Earth's existence. And that only can happen if you've got a planet-moon coupled magnetosphere like these recent research papers demonstrate.
Hugh, we have just over a minute left before noon time for us. Do you want to take one more question or do you want to do the breakout session now?
Well, I'll take one more question, but please give me one that doesn't have 15 parts to it.
Well, I've got one question from Doug McComb. He says, if there is no, if there's no suffering in heaven, why does 1 Corinthians 3:15 say that, quote, if any man's work shall be burned, he shall suffer loss, but he himself shall be saved, yet so as by fire? So is there suffering in heaven or not?
Yeah, good question from Doug. What we see in 1 Corinthians 3, 12 through 15, is basically the judgment seat for believers. And the difference is this: when God judges the unbelievers, he's going to judge them for all the evil things that they have done or said or thought. And when it comes to believers, he's going to judge us for all the good things we've thought or said or have done. And that's explained in the book of Ezekiel. The book of Ezekiel talks about how God is gracious and loving. He basically says to the unbelievers, I'm not going to judge you for your good deeds. Your good deeds are filthy rags. They're all done to glorify self, not to glorify me. If I were to judge them the way you want me to judge them, they would count against you. So I'm going to do you the favor. I'm simply going to forget all your good stuff. I'll only judge you on the stuff that we all recognize as evil. And the more evil that you've done, the greater the restraint and torment you'll experience in the lake of fire. For believers, it's the opposite. God says, hey, I've sacrificed myself. You are forgiven of all your evils and sins, past, present, and future, thoughts, words, and actions. All of it's been erased. I'm going to judge you simply on all the good that you've done on my behalf. And for those who've done much good, they'll receive a higher reward. And that's the context of 1 Corinthians 12 or 3, 12 through 15. God is basically saying, hey, when you finish this life up here on earth, you still got junk in your life. He calls it dross. You know, like we're silver, and God's going to get rid of all the dross. So we're pure gold, pure silver, purely righteous. And that's true. Did you know any human being here on planet Earth that isn't obnoxious to some degree? We all are. But God says to the believers, I'm going to get rid of all that. I'm going to remove everything from you that causes people to be repelled by you, causes people not to want to fellowship with you. All that's going to be driven away. And I'm looking forward to that. I think that's going to be great, where all that stuff is erased away from us and we can really have nothing blocking fellowship with one another. But the point of 1 Corinthians 12 through 15, some of us have a lot more dross than others. And it's that dross that's prevented us from doing the good that God wanted us to do. And basically God is saying to us, I'm going to put you through this refining fire. All that obnoxiousness is going to be removed. And all that's going to remain in you is that which is good. But for some of you, there's going to be a lot of good that'll remain. For others of you, there won't be so much. There will be different levels of reward in the new creation. And basically, that's what 1 Corinthians 12 is telling us. Hey, work hard in getting the dross out of your life now, because there's benefits in the new creation for you taking care of that now. But if you don't, I'm going to take you through the refining fire. All that's going to be gone. Nothing bad in you is going to go into the new creation. You're going to go in there completely pure. But the amount of purity is going to vary from Christian to Christian. That's why Paul says, run this life here on earth for all you're worth, because the prize is worth everything. And I love the fact that he uses an analogy of a race. Some are going to get a gold medal. Some are going to get a silver medal. Some of them are going to get a bronze medal. But every one of us gets to cross the finish line. But he says, go for the prize. Run for all you're worth. You get one shot at this life on earth. Make it count.
Well, thank you, Hugh, for another terrific presentation. That's going to be it for questions. If people have, I think we got through pretty much all of them. If people have more, then put them up. We'll get to them next week. Hugh, why don't you take over again and
break our session? What I'm going to do is share a screen and give you the URL again for joining our web meeting. And the web meeting is where we're all going to be able to turn on our cameras and microphones and be able to have some fellowship time with one another. So let me pop that up for you. Here we go. So this is a URL you're going to need to get into our web meeting. And once again, what we're going to do there is introduce ourselves to one another. It's a great way to get to know one another. But we're going to set up a role play where one of us will take the role of someone who's not yet a believer. And they meet someone who is a believer. So I'm going to get someone to take that role. And they find out that they are a Christian. Well, how did you become a Christian? And then I'm going to encourage whoever takes that role within 1 or 2 minutes, share your story of how you became a Christian. And then I'm going to encourage the rest of us to say, hey, we're all bystanders and we're interested in the conversation. Hey, can I ask a question here? And let's see how that works out. So with that, and by the way, this is the same address we've been using for the past several months. So if you got that, just use the same one. If you're new to the class, this is how you can get into the web meeting. But I'm going to close down the webinar. So we're all going to be booted off the webinar. And but then I'm going to open up the web meeting. And when you go into the web meeting, you will be put into a waiting room. Give me a minute or two to pull all of you from the waiting room into the web meeting. And but as soon as you're in the web meeting, feel free to start talking to one another, introducing yourselves to one another. So with that, let me stop the share feature. And I'll end the webinar and see all of you in the web meeting.